This is the Medicast, January 29th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 51. This is Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to thank all of you for checking out the show this week. I have a lot of information to impart to you. I had a great training session with my company with a Maryland State Police officer by the name of Dave Keller, and he gave us a great talk on the dangers of meth labs and ways that we can recognize that we might have stumbled into one. And I'm going to impart that information along with covering some information on methamphetamines a little later in this podcast with both the tip and trick of the week and the med of the week. So stick around. I got a lot of great information from him, and I can't wait to share it all with you. Of course, there's a lot that we need to go over first. First of all, I wanted to just check in with all of you that are brand new listeners to the show. I want to welcome you to the Medicast. Take a look at the website over at www.medicast.com. There's a lot of information over there. You can listen to all of the back podcasts. You can look at all of the information that I post up during the week between the shows. And you can access all of that right over there at the website. And I welcome you. Stick around for a couple of weeks and find out what the Medicast is all about. And of course, for all of you long-term listeners and contributors to the show, I want to thank you for coming back and checking in. Let's get moving on into some interesting information that I came up with this week. Well, I got quite a bit of listener email this week, so I'm going to jump right in and get into that. First item I got was from a listener, Chris, and he is a recent graduate of paramedic school and is looking for personal insurance in the liability malpractice area. And first of all, Chris, congratulations on graduating and welcome to our profession. I'm glad to have you. I know your colleagues are going to be glad to have you around. It's something that I think you're going to be feel very rewarded for getting involved in. But as far as liability insurance and personal malpractice insurance, he was asking me some questions about that. I'm going to look into this. This is something I think we need to probably do a special podcast on or a topic on. So I'm going to go and put this out to you guys. Do you all know of somebody that is someone you use for medical malpractice insurance for personal liability? If you do, you can put them in touch with me, and I'd be happy to interview them and talk a little bit about this issue in general. I've got some other contacts out. I'm going to look into talking with them as well. But I think this is an important issue to talk about, liability and how it affects us in the EMS field. So, Chris, thanks a lot for bringing this up, and I'll get more information on this as I proceed. I do know that you can head over to the National Association of EMTs site at naemt.org, and they have a company, I believe, that they recommend, or at least are saying that they're an up-and-up company. So you can check out their links over there. I think they have a link to that company through them. I'm not going to name it by name. Don't know it off the top of my head, but I do know that they have a link there to an organization that they have an affiliate program with. So thanks, Chris. I appreciate that, and good luck as you get started in your career. Listener Dave sent me an email and said he liked the show and had some good comments about the show, but wanted me to just talk a little bit about the use of student-run rescue and EMS squads on college campuses in and around those areas. And was I aware of these things? And absolutely, David, I absolutely am. In the University of Maryland program, first of all, Maryland's very supportive of their EMS and fire volunteers. And the University of Maryland has a very active program to teach classes and support them. And so the University of Maryland, several of the companies that are around the University of Maryland, even though it's right outside Washington, D.C., are still volunteer in many parts because they have students that they offer perks to stay in at the firehouse and run calls for them. And so these are largely student-run organizations. I have a couple members in my own company that have made use of this while they were in college, and they just loved it. You know, it kept them out of trouble. They were much happier to stay in at the firehouse and run calls and do what they really wanted to do while they were learning their programs in college. So I do know about this. Dave talked about he's a proud alumni of the University of Vermont Rescue Squad. That squad is now defunct as they've added paid ambulance service in that area. But you know what, Dave? It's great to be a member of something like that. And, you know, I urge you to keep in touch with your members. I hope you all have an alumni association or a way to get back together periodically, because it's important to share your memories of things like that. But Dave, thanks for your comments. And, you know, if anyone else knows of services like this out there, let me know. I'd be interested in learning a bit more about them. I also got an email from a listener by the name of Tyler, who is based in Basra, Iraq. So Tyler, if you're listening, keep your head down, bud. And Tyler was excited about finding the podcast. And he is a longtime listener of another podcast called The EM Wrap, and by a Dr. Mel Herbert. I'm going to have to check that out. You know, I'm not familiar with that podcast, but Tyler, thank you for giving me the heads up, and I'll have to go and check out that show. So Tyler, if you ever have any comments about what's going on as far as your medical service in Iraq and want to talk about kind of what you see medically on the front lines there and what you're doing, please get back to me. On a similar note, I got an email from a listener, Marshall, who is a member of the 82nd Airborne over in Iraq. He's stationed there now. And first of all, Marshall, I want to thank you and Tyler for your service, and make sure you guys are in our thoughts and prayers and you come home safely. We hope to have you home as soon as is feasibly possible. But he just wanted to let me know that he enjoys listening to this show. And so this is a shout out to you and all of your other medic friends that listen to the MedicCast together. I hope that I provide some good relief for you and something to listen to. So thanks for listening to the show. And please email me if you have anything you want me to cover or have any comments you'd like to share with the other listeners. How do you contact the MedicCast? Well, a couple of easy ways. You can leave me an email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also reach me at the MedicCast voicemail line at 941-306-3342, and you can leave a voicemail message there. That's 941-30-MEDIC. You can also sign up for the MedicCast email newsletter, and that's a new email newsletter. If you're already signed up for my email updates, I've transferred your email addresses over to the newsletter service that I'm using. Everything's confidential, but you can find a link to that in the show notes or on the MedicCast front page in the upper right-hand corner. And if you're signed up for the MedicCast newsletter, I'll be drawing names from that list to give away some prizes over the next, I guess in the next couple of weeks, 3 weeks, for the 1 year anniversary of the MedicCast, to celebrate the end of 1 year and to look forward to the new one. So you want to get on the email list. I don't sell that information. It's not a spam list. You'll get one email or so a week, which will let you know when the MedicCast is out and what it's about. And I'll also be doing an extra newsletter once a month or so for just the newsletter subscribers with some extra added information that I've come up with just for the newsletter. So you want to get signed up for that over at the website, which is at MedicCast.com. And once you're there, you can leave comments there as well. Check out each of the individual postings. I put up probably 4 or 5 additional posts a week on top of the MedicCast show notes. So it's a great opportunity for you to learn about other things going on in the medical field over at MedicCast.com. The link of the week this week is one called medicalmnemonics.com, and that's medical mnemonics. And for those of you who don't know how to spell mnemonics, which I didn't at first, it's MNEMONICS, medicalmnemonics.com. For those of you that don't know what medical mnemonics are, I suspect you already use them in one form or another, but these are the little songs or rhymes or sentences we remember to try to help us learn our protocols, to learn our parts of the body, to learn the procedures that we need to learn in our practice. And medical demonics cover everything from nurses to doctors to EMS. And so over at medicalmnemonics.com, you can search for mnemonics to use. If you're an instructor, this is a great resource for you. Also, they have a downloadable free database for your Palm OS. So if you guys have a Palm Pilot or some kind of PDA that runs the Palm OS, you can actually download a free version of this database and have it with you at all times. You can customize it. You can add to it. If you have one that you use that isn't on the database, it's just a great website and a great way for you. If you're having trouble learning something or having trouble teaching something, you can go over there and maybe get some extra resources to use in that process at medicalmnemonics.com. And of course, there'll be a link in the show notes for this episode. Moving right on into the news. The first item in the news tonight has to do with funding of local emergency services and funding of local emergency training. And I'm a big proponent of that. I think that is a great use of public funds. I think you can't do much better than funding local training for EMS, fire, and police officers. I think it's a great return on your investment. This particular story comes out of the Scott County Times out of Mississippi, and it has to do with the fact that Scott County was among a group of local governments that received funding from the state to improve their local emergency services. They recently awarded $595,403 in emergency service operating funds to 35 cities and counties across the state of Mississippi, and Scott County got $12,909, which will be used for training of emergency medical technicians. You know, I didn't realize how lucky I was to be from the state of Maryland until I started learning more about how emergency services operate in other parts of the country. And I was surprised to find out that most other places, you're required to kind of pay for a lot of this training yourself. And I was not aware that I was as lucky as I was. Maryland is very proactive in funding volunteer training. They have an entire department of the University of Maryland system called the Maryland Fire Rescue Institute, which offers free training all over the state, supported by local fire departments. So they train in the local community at the fire departments. They have instructors they provide, and they provide that training for free. You can get EMTB, Fire 1, Fire Officer, EMS Officer, rescue training, you name it, they've got it, as well as ALS recertification training. And so it's just something I really took for granted until I realized that a lot of you guys are paying for your own EMT and paramedic training. So I'm really glad to see that this is catching on in other places. I think that this is money well spent. You know, yeah, there are some EMTs we train and they only hang out for a little while and then they disappear off into the ether somewhere and maybe they don't use their training anymore. But you know what? You've trained somebody in some basic emergency techniques and you've trained them in an awareness at least of emergency techniques, and they become a valuable resource down the road when you need public support for what you do. So I think that training people and funding free training for at least EMTB level training is just money that comes back to you, you know, 100-fold. You can't qualify or quantify that really, because it is something that just pays back in so many different ways. So I applaud the state of Mississippi for doing this. I hope to see a lot of other states pull this kind of thing off and really get behind their local emergency departments and fire and rescue companies. The next item in the news comes out of Texas and has to do with a test run they're doing for having emergency vehicles that are on duty no longer have to pay Department of Transportation tolls on toll highways and bridges. And this is another thing that kind of like stumped me for a minute, because we have some bridges that are toll roads around here. And yeah, we obviously you don't pay if you're running lights and sirens. But we ran into this problem a few years ago because we had mutual aid companies from Pennsylvania nearby transporting our patients to a hospital that happened to be across the Susquehanna River. What happened was they'd run to the hospital and they'd be running lights and sirens and wouldn't pay at the toll booth. But then the people coming back tried to hit him for the toll, $4 to come back across the river and go back home. And it wasn't a shorter way to do it. They had to go the way they had to go. They were letting us go because they knew we were local companies, and so they thought the Pennsylvania company was a commercial ambulance and wanted to charge them for transporting and covering our calls. Now, commercial interfacility transport services, I think it's a no-brainer. They should just be paying for the cost of what they do. But for public service agencies, even if you're a private ambulance company that is contracted for a local area, you should be, you know, not having to pay for that. Certainly in my area, where all the companies are volunteer organizations, we shouldn't be forcing them to pay for tolls. So I hope this works out for Texas. Basically, they're going to not charge for on-duty paramedic, police, or fire vehicles, but they will expect them to be on duty, and they won't have to be responding to an emergency with their lights on to be exempt from paying those tolls. So I hope this works out, and I can't see that they'd be losing that much money from the few emergency vehicles that travel on these highways when compared to the number of other vehicles that are out there. I talked a little earlier about the good idea of paying to train your EMTs and kind of use state funding for training. Well, out of a site called northjersey.com from the state of New Jersey, there's a great column that talks about how the cost of losing volunteers and not taking care of your volunteers is going to end up being a pain in the pocketbook. And that's the words of the author there. Basically, there's been such a shortage of volunteers in some areas that were really routinely served by volunteer EMS services that these local areas have had to start paying for paid EMS responders, at least on certain shifts. And this person points out, and rightly so, that I don't think the public has any idea what the true cost to them would be if they had to pay for full-time, round-the-clock EMS and fire coverage in some of these more rural and suburban areas. I know that lately, I think probably at the end of the 90s, there were anywhere between 70 to 80% of all the fire departments in the country were volunteer, and I think at least 60 or 70% of them, of the EMS services in the country, were volunteer, largely because they served rural areas that really just didn't have the tax base to support any kind of full-time public safety service that was on call all the time. So read this if you're in a situation where you're having trouble getting support for your volunteers, or there's something coming up in your local or state government that talks about maybe offering some kind of tax incentive or perks to your volunteers, you might want to check out this particular article off of northjersey.com. And of course, you'll find a link to that in the show notes. I found a great article off of EMSresponder.com that talks about New York Code Blue teams in local New York City hospitals that were dealing with cardiac emergencies before they became full-blown cardiac arrests, and how this was really improving the numbers of cardiac arrests that they were seeing in these hospitals. So, for instance, cardiac arrests outside of intensive care units at Bellevue in one hospital month turned from 11 per month on average to 2 per month on average, according to the data after they instituted Code Blue teams. And what these teams were was doctors and nurses and other medical personnel that formed into roving groups of quick responders that came into the hospital setting from different areas to respond to like the ICU or to different medical units in the hospital when there was someone having a sudden cardiac event. And what they were able to do is by rapidly responding and training quickly together, they were able to provide a rapid response to the cardiac event in such a way that they were able to stave off arrest in many cases. And this is exciting. You know, this is what we do, but it's been applied in the hospital setting so that they have their own emergency response team. And I thought that was really an interesting application of resources. And it's clearly had a benefit based on the numbers that they have. So check out this particular article. But it brings up something else that kind of occurred to me. why don't we have cardiac arrest or emergency response code blue teams in our services? I know that in my area, we have multiple ALS units responding when there's a cardiac arrest because we've tried to put together a situation where we have more than one paramedic on scene, or at least more than one paramedic en route to assist when they get to the scene. But what about carrying it one step further? What about those patients that we really have a great suspicion they're having a full-blown MI, whether we have ST elevation or other signs and symptoms that lead us in that direction? Maybe we should be having a quick response unit that we can call to assist us in holding that person off from actually going into arrest. You know, we've all had them where we're sitting there wringing our hands and trying to keep everything going while we get this patient to the hospital. And, you know, the pucker factor's going on. We're riding to the hospital and we're sitting there in the back of our minds going, oh God, please don't code on me. Come on, just keep going till we get you to the ER. Well, maybe there's a situation where we can call for additional help and get another person in the back. Maybe it's an intermediate trained person. Maybe it's an EMTB with IV skills to help you start a second line. There's a lot of things that we can do to put another trained person in the back and provide additional level of care. And by doing that, we can maybe hold off a few of these arrests that are going to occur in the back of our units and get these people to the hospital before they go into cardiac arrest. And hey, count that as a save too, right? Finally, an item on the subject of gallows humor and EMS. Well, you know, I think some people think we're like the sickest puppies on the face of the earth because we just have the sickest sense of humor sometimes. And we have to be aware that sometimes that sense of humor in the eyes of the public can be extremely cold and callous. But I found a great column over at emsresponder.com that talks about the fact that gallows humor is absolutely 100% necessary for EMS crews to cope with what we do on an everyday basis. EMS crews, fire, police officers, all of us, we see things that most people don't see in a lifetime, and we see it several times a week or several times a month or even more frequently. And our natural way to cope with that as human beings is to come up with a way to laugh it off. And it's painful. It's painful for us to do that. But by laughing, we make light of the situation, and it gives us the ability to go on. You know, over at gems.com, if you sign up for their newsletter, you get a cartoon of the week from Steve Barry, who produces great material for EMS simply because he's a paramedic like us and sees the same things we see. And so when he writes a cartoon about something that's happened funny to him or something that's occurred to him, it is right on the money. It is right there. You can check out his stuff over at IamNotAnAmbulanceDriver.com. He has some books of his cartoons out there that, you know, if you want to get something, just leave around the firehouse or upset your in-laws because they'll look at it and think you're crazy, but you'll sit there and read it and chuckle through it all the time. So it's important for us to do these things. And yeah, there's a right and a wrong time to do it. And sometimes we laugh at the wrong time when the public overhears what we say. But I'm not that concerned about it. You know what? They'll get over it. They're still going to call us when they need help. We should try to be aware of who's standing around, but we've all made comments to make us laugh in awkward situations like this. And I've done it too. So, and guess what? You know, people at the firehouse will look at me sometimes when I'm over there, and usually especially when it's late at night and I'm tired and I've been running calls a lot, I get a little crazy and start talking insane stuff. And so when I make a comment earlier in the day, people will look at me and say, you know, look at the clock and go, Jamie, it's not 12 o'clock yet. It's not late enough for you to start acting like that. So I'm just as guilty of it as the rest of us are. And I think we need to encourage using humor in our workplace to deal with some of these things, along with the other resources we have to help us cope with what we see. Well, as I said earlier in the podcast, this week's tip and trick of the week is going to have to do with recognizing the signs that you've walked into a meth lab or are getting close to a meth lab and some of the things that you might be able to recognize and do to protect yourself. I had an excellent class with Trooper First Class Dave Keller of the Maryland State Police. He taught my company and a couple other neighboring companies about the ongoing efforts of Maryland State Police here dealing with meth labs. For those of you on the West Coast and in the Midwest, this is something you all have been dealing with for years. But interestingly enough, it's moved across the country from the West Coast, and it's just now entering the Central Atlantic area. And Maryland is being very proactive with dealing with this problem. But there's a lot of information here. If you don't have a local meth lab training class, you might want to check out his site, Dave Keller's site, over at mspmethlabs.com. And on that site, he actually has the PowerPoint that he taught his class from for us, and you can download it and use it for your own service if you need to. He's also available there for contact if you'd like to get in touch with him about some of the places he's found resources or how to set up a training program in your own area. I think he'd be happy to help out whether you're from the state of Maryland or not. He just seemed like that kind of guy. So what do we do when you come upon a situation and you're not sure what's going on and you wonder if you walked into a meth lab or not? One of the things Dave talked to us about was that the biggest indicator for us is likely to be the trash or the things that they're throwing out in the trash. And this has to do with the nature of the items that are used to cook up the meth and the ingredients that they use to filter and work on the methamphetamines, work on the things they need. First of all, we all know that Sudafed is a required ingredient for producing methamphetamines. It's one of the reasons that the federal government in the last year enacted a law that restricted access to large amounts of Sudafed unless you had to provide a driver's license. You can only buy so much at a time. And that seems to have cut back on a lot of things here in the state of Maryland. So if you see, you know, in the trash as you're walking into the house, you look in the trash can and there's empty blister packs of Sudafed in there, like 10, 15, 20 of them, or empty boxes of Sudafed laying around, you might want to start thinking in that direction. You know, either everybody in the house has a really bad cold or they're cooking meth. The other thing is strong or unusual odors, smells like cat urine, smells of ether, ammonia, acetone, or other chemical smells are an indicator. Blacked out windows. A lot of times these people will spray paint the windows black or will duct tape covers over the windows so you can't see in. That would also be an indicator. Also, other trash items you might find. A lot of antifreeze containers, red stained coffee filters. One of the methods used to cook up the drug is to strain the substance through coffee filters, and you'll end up with coffee filters that are stained bright red or a deep rust red. This is not the color of coffee, folks, so if you see red stained coffee filter in the trash, they might have been cooking meth there recently. Also, things like lantern fuel containers, starter fluid, brake fluid, things like that. If they have 10 or 15 or 20 cans of lantern fuel containers in the trash, you know, one's enough, maybe two. Why do they have so many? These should all be kind of putting lights off and encouraging you to kind of look around and be more careful with what you're doing. So, you know, why do we need to be so aware of this? Well, aside from the fact of the illegal nature of things that are going on in the household, we need to be aware of the fact that almost every time that a meth lab is raided, guns are involved, where maybe they aren't shooting guns, but they find illegal weapons in the house. So right there is a concern for you that the people that you're providing services for are likely to be armed and have concealed weapons somewhere nearby. So you need to handle yourself appropriately. If you see this, you might want to make an excuse to try to get out of the house and go out and call for some assistance if you're able to do so. The other problem is that the extreme toxic nature of the substances and the byproducts of producing methamphetamines are extremely toxic and can start causing contact highs to you. Whether you're in the environment and you start having some side effects, you start becoming dizzy, you start becoming lightheaded, maybe your partner is getting confused or having trouble staying focused. You know, all these things can be indications that you've had a light contact with the side effect residue of methamphetamines. And you can tell that it's, you know, it'll clear up maybe when you get out of the house, but maybe you need to get checked out yourself. What other things? Well, remember that you can have all kinds of problems from coming in contact with these things. Your bags are going to have residue on them. Your clothes are going to have residue on them. And the other problem is that the products of cooking up methamphetamines can be highly flammable and explosive. So you need to be aware that maybe even the act of flipping on a light switch could cause a flash fire or an explosion in the home. So it's really something you need to kind of keep your eyes out for. Most often these homes are found in isolated areas. If they're cooking a lot out of the same house, they're going to be in an isolated area to deal with the smells. But you might also have somebody who's in a motor vehicle and running the lab in the trunk of their car and traveling around so they can be more mobile and less easy to find. So you need to be aware of situations like that. The other thing is hotel rooms. People will rent a hotel or a motel room and set up a lab. It only takes 6 to 8 hours to cook up a load of meth. So what do? They get in there, they get all the materials in there, they start cooking it up. Maybe somebody has an overdose because they're using other drugs, or there's a flash fire or some other thing, and you have a person with chemical burns and you're not sure where the burns came from. Maybe there's residue on their person or on their clothing. So you might want to call for some assistance. All of this information and a whole lot more is all available over at the website at mspmethlabs.com. Courtesy of Trooper First Class Dave Keller of the Maryland State Police. I urge you to head over and check out his website. You can find a link to it in the show notes, along with some other information on meth labs that I found. Going hand in hand with this week's tip and trick of the week is going to be the information about methamphetamines itself. Now, I've covered meth and some other drugs in an episode I did back in episode 7 on club drugs, and you'll actually find a link back to that episode in the show notes, so you can check back and see what I had to say about that. There's also a link to the National Institute on Drug Abuse site, the NIDA site, NIDA.NIH.gov, and that's a great site. If you want to learn anything about anything on drug abuse in this country, all of the funding information on publications dealing with parents and teachers, young adults, health professional information, it's all there at the National Institute on Drug Abuse site. And you can find a lot more about methamphetamines and a lot of other drugs over at that site. So I urge you to head over and check it out. Methamphetamines is a highly addictive synthetic stimulant drug that activates certain systems in the brain. Basically, it encourages high production of dopamine, the neurotransmitter that helps us feel good. It is a mood-enhancing stimulant in our brain. So the methamphetamine causes our body to release just tons of this stuff. It enhances our mood, enhances our body movement. But the problem is that methamphetamine is very strong, very potent, and much more longer lasting and harmful to the central nervous system than any other amphetamine that has been produced up to this point. Methamphetamines is not new. It's been around for a long time. It was produced in the time of World War II to keep soldiers on both sides of the war awake for long periods of time so they could fight better in battle. It's a Schedule II drug, which means it has a high potential for abuse, but it's a Schedule II drug. So there are situations where methamphetamines is prescribed in controlled amounts to certain people with medical issues like narcolepsy. Also, it's very closely related to a lot of other medications out there, including medications like the stimulants used to treat attention deficit disorder, and of course, very close in combination and chemical composition to the drug ephedrine, which is why they use Sudafed to turn the drug into methamphetamine. It has many street names. It's known as speed, meth, chalk, sometimes known as ice, crystal, glass. It is related and often called the poor man's cocaine. But where cocaine has a relatively short duration of effect, methamphetamines can last for 8 to 10 hours in the system. And the problem with long-term meth use is that by creating the body and forcing the body to produce such high levels of neurotransmitters in the brain, it actually burns out the receptors for those neurotransmitters. So basically what you end up having is a person that has been forced into feeling good by this drug over a long period of time actually reaches a point where they can no longer sense the chemical that they need to feel good. And that's just a horrible thing if you think about it. You know, you burn out your ability to feel good about yourself. And then you need more and more methamphetamine to try to kick up more and more of that neurotransmitter to overload the receptor sites you have left. And of course, that burns them out too. So if you look at some of the information that you have on that website that I gave you back in the tip and trick of the week, there's a thing there called Faces of Meth. And if you've seen this before, it's striking to see the changes in the people over just even a short duration of methamphetamine use. Methamphetamines is taken orally, also intranasally when they snort it as a powder, by needle injection, or by smoking. Trooper Keller told me in his class the other day that they are also finding people who are actually taking the chunks of the medication and inserting it rectally. So they're taking it actually in a lot of just about every different way you can get it into the body, they're taking it. Another thing he wanted to tell me about was that in about 25% of the situations where they had a person that thought they were taking ecstasy, they were actually taking methamphetamines. And this was very disturbing because they have a similar chemical composition, but ecstasy is not as toxic to the body as methamphetamines is and has a different effect. So you could be thinking that you're buying ecstasy and you're really maybe 25% of the time getting methamphetamines. And of course, it's highly addictive substance, so you're putting yourself at great danger. So that's something to be aware of. If you have a person that you suspect their friends are telling you, well, they use some ecstasy, be suspicious. Look at their signs and symptoms. Maybe they've taken methamphetamine by mistake because they didn't know what it was they were taking. What are the side effects and signs and symptoms we're looking for? Well, people taking even small amounts of meth can have side effects like increased wakefulness, increased physical activity, decreased appetite, increased respirations, tachycardia, irregular heartbeat or dysrhythmias, increased blood pressure, and hyperthermia. Other effects may include irritability, anxiety, insomnia, confusion, tremors or convulsions, seizure activity, and also cardiac collapse and death. Long-term effects, somebody that's been on meth for some time, can include paranoia and aggressiveness, extreme anorexia, memory loss, and as well as hallucinations, delusions, and severe dental problems, what somebody called meth mouth. And this is actually because they smoke it, and also they crave sugar, and it causes an erosion of the dental enamel. And then, of course, the increased sugar that they eat because they crave it actually causes the increased tooth decay. So there's a whole lot of issues that go along with it. Also, be aware that because this is an illegal drug use situation, you have a person that's at higher risk for having HIV, hepatitis B and C, and other easily transmitted bloodborne pathogens. So protect yourself. Make sure you're aware of what people are using and make sure you're wearing your protective equipment and gear. The treatment for methamphetamines, basically you're going to monitor the patient, you're going to want to get a good set of vitals, and you're going to want to trend those vitals. And of course, treat any cardiac dysrhythmias that you may see. You may have a patient that's in tachycardia. Basically the definitive treatment is to get this person to the hospital, where they can come down off their high and then get treatment for their addiction. However, you need to be aware that these people are easily agitated and can be abusive, and so you want to protect yourself. This is the call where you might want to have an extra person riding in the back with you. You may want to request a police officer to ride along. I don't know what your local protocols might be, but make sure you're just aware of that. Basically, this is a situation where you're going to treat the patient's symptoms, whatever symptoms they're manifesting with, and really keep an eye out to protecting yourself. So that's methamphetamines. Head on over to the National Institute on Drug Abuse site that I have a link to in the show notes, and you can get a whole lot more information on this and a whole bunch of other drugs over there at that site. And that's going to wrap up the show. As always, make sure you check back at medicast.com for all of the links in the show notes for this week's episode. Everything that I've talked about here today, you can find out more complete and full information on over at the sites that I've linked to from the show notes link, as well as I will be adding more information, as I always do, all week long on different things I come across to let you know about other topics that are important to EMS in the medical field. If you want to support the show, there's a couple of different ways you can do that. You can, of course, visit the website, as I just said. You can also check out the Medicast store at store.medicast.com. And that's a site for the Amazon.com store that's an affiliate link for the Medicast. If you're going to be shopping for something over there, buying textbooks for the new semester or anything like that, you can go ahead and link over there to the store.medicast.com. And anything you buy, a little bit comes back to the Medicast and helps support the show. As always, you can leave comments over at podmedic@mac.com by email or at the voicemail line at 941-30-MEDIC. That's 941-306-3342. You can also leave comments on the website and each of the postings there. And there's some great comments that have been posted recently about some of the things I've put up on the site, and you can head over there and check all of that out. Of course, make sure you tell a friend about the show and sign up for the Medicast newsletter. There's a link on the site and in the show notes to do that. And tell everybody about the Medicast and all the great information you found out over here. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This week, I got some musical advice from one of the listeners who sent me a link to one of his friends by the name of Phil Ayoub, who has a song called Welcome to the Nightlife, Bad Day. I think that's strangely appropriate for those of us in the EMS field, and it's a pretty good tune. So if you like what you hear, head over to the show notes and link on over to Phil's site, and you'll get a chance to listen to a bunch of his music. And I appreciate him making this song available for me to use here on the Medicast. Without further ado, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Dressed like a sidewalk, pale as a groom, knocked out, bloodshot, Polaroid green. It's a bad day to be left here in the park. It's a long way to be flying in the dark. It's a long day to be lost and lonely. Bad day. far. It's a long day, they'll be crawling in the dark. But you don't say these lost and lonely.